WFYI podcast brought to you by Bloomington, Indiana, an American college town offering food and drink, college sports, outdoor activities, live music, cool art, and good times daily. Everyone is welcome in Bloomington. More information at visitbloomington.com.
We're going to take a trip right now. Like we always do about this time.
This is a journey into sound. Break it
down. I'm Kyle Long, and you're listening to Cultural Manifesto. Up first, on this week's show, I'll be speaking with the experimental musician, civic leader, and artist manager, Michael Kaufman. And during the second half of the show, we'll celebrate Asian American and Pacific Islander Heritage Month by listening to music from Marmar A, an important Burmese singer living in Fort Wayne, Indiana. Michael Kaufman is a significant figure in the Indianapolis arts and culture scene. Michael is a musician. He's part of a long-running noise duo called Therefore. And he's also created experimental hip-hop music under the name Future Rapper. But you're more likely to be familiar with Michael's work behind the scenes. For many years, Michael managed Sufjan Stevens' Asthmatic Kitty Records label. He was also Vice President of Civic Investment for Health and Hospital Corporation in Indianapolis. Over the last few years, Michael has focused his time on Maru, his own artist management agency. Maru has represented important Indianapolis-related musicians, including Hannah Benn, Emily Wells, and the rap group Bless. And Michael also manages the experimental pop trio Sunlux. The group was recently nominated for 2 Academy Awards for their soundtrack to the film Everything Everywhere All at Once. And Michael Kaufman joins me now to discuss all of this and more. Thank you for being here, Michael.
Absolutely. Thank you for having me, Kyle.
You've been very busy this year. One of the groups that you currently manage, Sunlux, just performed at the Academy Awards. The soundtrack they created for the film Everything Everywhere All at Once was nominated for 2 awards. So congratulations. We're going to talk about that.
Thank you.
First, I wanted to talk a little more generally about your work in artist management. You have a company called Maru.
Yeah, Maru. Open for discussion.
M-E-R-U. And when I was talking to Sunlux last year, I interviewed all 3 of the guys after Everything Everywhere All at Once came out. You know, they said you were more than a manager. You know, they almost talked about you as though you're a creative equal in the band.
Well, I mean, I think as an artist manager, they're welcome to make that claim. I don't think I should make that claim, but that's very flattering. I do like to think of myself, though, as being actively involved in the creative development of the artists that we work with, but also the personal developments. And so, you know, I always talk to the artists that I want to support them realizing their, you know, their full self in all aspects of their life. And I think the creative side, you know, having a background with Asthmatic Kitty Records as a label manager and doing a lot of project management, there was often a lot of creative decisions that I was informing or participating in, whether that be album art or even song selection. And Ryan and I have worked together now, Ryan of Sunlux, and I have worked together for, almost 16 years, I believe. We have a rapport where he is very welcoming of my suggestions and ideas. And, you know, but then there's also artists who have a much more self-contained or singular vision for what they want to do. And I respect that and, you know, try to find what the appropriate level of engagement is depending upon the artist and their desires.
You mentioned that you've known Ryan Lott, the founder of Sunlux, for 16 years, and I did want to ask you about how you two connected. Ryan has a lot of history in Indiana, although he wasn't born here and
yeah.
wasn't raised here either. Tell me how you got connected with Ryan Lott.
It's kind of a hilarious story, at least to me it is. So when I was working at Asthmatic Kitty, I had been asked to be a judge for an unsigned band competition that was part of this Calvin College Festival of Faith and Music. And myself and this guy from who was like an editor at Pace Magazine, you know, I had to listen through 30 or so demos, and Ryan had submitted one, and there was three or four songs, and it was clearly, you know, heads and shoulders above, if that's even the right term, I don't know. It stood out amongst the batch significantly, and one of the prizes for being selected was to open for my wife, Liz Janes, who was performing in this chapel as part of the festival. And I was actually at the hotel with our kiddos while Liz was performing, so I didn't even see Ryan perform. And that was one of his first, I think that was his first public performance as Sunlux. But he gave Liz a CDR of his songs, like the full demos for what became At War, Walls and Mazes. And he had a, you know, his phone number scrawled with a Sharpie on the, you know, the days of the CDR, right? You know, I listened to it and immediately was just like, this is incredible. And I was really trying to encourage Asthmatic Kitty to put it out. And for whatever reason, where we were at, the way A&R selections happened at Asthmatic Kitty would be, you know, between myself, Lowell, and Sufjan, and some sort of, almost unanimous, you know, kind of decision. Sometimes there'd be, you know, one of us would be like, on the fence about something, we might still do it. But, you know, and it wasn't a question of quality or interest. I think just the timing of it just didn't feel right. And so I offered to work with Ryan, and I wanted to help him. And I helped him get signed to Anti-Con at the time, which was a really great sort of experimental hip hop label. And just one thing led to another, you know, and you know, always in the background, I that would be sort of my, you know, more than a passion project because he was paying me, but you know, really work together to help build his career.
As I mentioned, Sunlux performed at the Academy Awards with David Byrne and Stephanie Sue. Really an incredible moment for fans of experimental music to see this great band perform on this huge stage. From what I understand, you were there. Right?
I was.
Tell us about this experience of being part of this group that got nominated for this award and got to go to the Academy Awards.
Yeah. Well, I think it started... Well, first off, the film, being a part of the film is the award. Like, it's, you know, what an amazing moment and piece of art to be associated with. Even, you know, for me, through my work with Sunlux, but also, you know, I have a credit as original music consultant in the film, and that's merely because I helped assemble this end credit song with David Byrne and Stephanie, or Mitski, sorry. And so... You know, when they announced the shortlist, so the way that the Oscars work is there is first you submit, and, you know, so many films get submitted. And of those films, there's a shortlist of 15, I believe, titles, 15 movies in each category that have been shortlisted. And so we got shortlisted for song and score, and that was like, oh, amazing. That's great. And, you know, we were not necessarily holding our breath for getting nominated. And in fact, you know, when we first, this really cracked me up. When we were talking about the feasibility of being nominated, we were working with a film score publicist, and that's their job to help run these campaigns. And his response, I asked him, like, what was the feasibility of us getting nominated for score specifically? And he said, well, there's four slots because it's a John Williams year. And I was like, what does that mean? He's like, well, anytime there's a John Williams film, it's pretty much defaulted that he will be nominated. He's been nominated 53 times. I think it's 53 or 51. Mm-hmm. I've seen it listed two different ways. And so that you know, so okay, all of a sudden now there's only four spots as opposed to five spots. And we were also told it's a very, you know, the consensus seemed to be that it's a very conservative body within the Academy, right? So each award has a body of governors that then selects who gets nominated. Once you're nominated, the final award is chosen by the full Academy, although you're discouraged from voting on something that you don't have a lot of familiarity with. I don't know how that plays out. I don't know enough about how the voting works, if that's really the case or not. But anyways, so when we were watching the live stream of the announcement of the nominees, and there was a part of me that felt like we had maybe a shot with Song just because of David Byrne and Mitski. And I felt like we were the sort of the indie darling sort of, you know, underdog of that, that, you know, if you think about the curation of, you know, who am I going to select, and we would appeal to a certain demographic in that regard. And so they announced Score first, and when they, and Sunlux, I believe, was last. And so it came up, and I literally lost my breath. Like, I was like, I just got so emotional and like overwhelmed, because I just couldn't, I was completely in shock. You know, of course, like, you know, you don't want to, you know, do things for the awards, you know, but there was something very validating, you know, after working with this band for so long. You know, we've had other moments that I feel like are equally significant in their accolade or accomplishment, but there was something very like, oh, okay, wow, this is real, and these guys, you know, score this film that's being acknowledged in this way, and was very rewarding. And we went to the Academy Awards, and what the big takeaway for me was, and I think in large part because of Everything Everywhere All at Once being so prominent, it really had a spirit, you know, like part of me, there's part of me that could have easily gone very, very cynical about all this. Like, oh, this is so much money, there's politics, and, you know, I mean, what doesn't have politics, though? I mean, even in, you know, small indie scenes have politics, you know, through, and maybe sometimes more politics. But, you know, so there was, it would be easy to go into it cynical. But, you know, we sat on the lower floor, sort of in the back portion where all the technical award people sat. So like best animation, you know, best short, you know, documentary, et cetera. And so being there with those people as their awards were getting announced, and just the enthusiasm and the genuine excitement for the craft, you know, and then also other people cheering on other awards, there just was really a spirit of, these are people who love their craft, and this is a moment to celebrate their craft. And yeah, there's a lot of money involved, but there's also a lot of instances where there isn't a lot of money involved. You know, Everything Everywhere All at Once was a relatively small budget film. And more what people gravitated towards was these really incredible stories of people who've kept at it, you know, like Brendan Fraser, you know, Jamie Lee Curtis, and, you know, Michelle and Key, like, you know, I feel like people were celebrating the spirit of the keep at-ness of all these people. Despite all the other stuff, this really is a celebration of craft.
This is a life.
Every possibility.
Free from destiny.
I choose you and you choose me.
Not what we sow, not only what we show. This is light.
And Michael, I wanted to ask you about an aspect of your work that interests me. There is always sort of a local, a national, and international aspect to everything you do. When I met you, you were working for Asthmatic Kitty Records. You were managing the label. You know, this label was founded by Sufjan Stevens and had a lot of notable artists associated with the label. But you also brought in Jukebox, a local Indianapolis favorite here, indie rock band here in the community. You're artist management agency. You know, you're working with Sunlux, but you also worked with the local hip-hop group Bless for a period of time. The soundtrack to Everything Everywhere All at Once, you know, included Randy Newman and Hannah Benn from here in Indianapolis, who you also managed.
Yeah.
There's definitely, through all the work you do, this Indianapolis component and this sort of international component that all comes together. Tell me about that aspect of your work, and if that's intentional, and if so, why is it important to you?
Yeah, and I should, you know, add a note about Bless. I love those guys. I think those guys are so, so talented. And it's exciting to see them continue in their work and grow. I was starting to realize I've had a lot of stuff just happening even, you know, personally and professionally, where it became clear to me that I needed to focus on Sun Lux and then Holland Andrews, who I also represent, and then just, you know, as secondary manager for the rest of our roster at Maru. And, you know, what was rewarding about working with Bless was just seeing those guys, you know, giving those guys just some tool, like helping them sort of refine skills they already had and, you know, helping them identify how best to apply those things. And so to see them, you know, kind of they just went to South By, and just watching them has been very rewarding, to feel like they've got a great future ahead of them. And so, yeah. And I think, like, so that local, non-local, you know, for me, it's, I don't know. I don't know if it's – I think early on it was very intentional. Like when I was doing A&R for Asthmatic Kitty, you know, when I lived in San – I started in San Diego, and we signed a couple San Diego-based artists while also signing non-San Diego-based artists. And some of that was just being active in the music scene myself, right? And then, you know, when we moved here, I saw – I think it was Big Big Car, right? It was David Moose Adamson's previous – and I just remember being blown away by it. And then – you know, kind of watching as he started Jukebox, and just like, man, we got to, you know, I want to work with this. So some of that was just local exposure. I, you know, in my career is like 10 years of Asthmatic Kitty, 10 years with Health and Hospital Corporation, and now back to music full time. I think as I kind of enter in this third phase, you know, to be totally honest and transparent, I'm not very engaged locally musically anymore. You know, I am working, you know, as a consultant to Central Indiana Community Foundation on trails and connectivity, which is sort of an odd dual, you know, role that I play. So I am still very committed to being invested in my community and where I am. In the past, that's been more through arts and culture. I think now that for me, that's through the trails and greenways work that I do, and maybe less so through the arts and culture side of things. But yeah, to me, you know, talent is not, you know, geographically specific. And so I know there's lots of incredibly talented people here. I think there's some sort of overarching cultural themes here that are unfortunate, which we can talk more about if you want, that sort of prevent artists to sort of break out of indie. You know, and then there's some larger cultural issues that I get easily frustrated by here in indie. And so for my own sort of personal mental health, I've had to pull away from that a little bit, because I realize, you know, a lot of what I was championing sometimes was just something that I was more aesthetically, you know, interested in. And it's not that good things aren't happening here. They're just not always things that I'm particularly interested in. And that's okay. Like, that's fine. And so I don't think, you know, your cultural sustenance needs to necessarily come always from local. But I think being part of a local community, in whether it's an art community, a bike community, a whatever that community is, it is good to have some of that local community. I realized I don't have to have them totally tethered, if that makes sense. Mm.
You mentioned you're not particularly active in a hands-on way with the music community here in Indianapolis today. But over the last 10 or 15 years, you've been very involved in different ways in the local music community. As you're doing work nationally and internationally, as I mentioned, I'm curious, you know, what sort of you see as the strengths and weaknesses here in the local music culture?
Yeah, yeah. No, you're right. I mean, and thank you for saying that. I mean, I guess, like, as I even take a step back, I'm like, oh, yeah, I did sound expeditions.
Right.
I did the Museum of Psychphonics, and, you know, I've done other things, put on shows and whatnot. Yeah, I think, you know, I think one of the things that indie struggles with, and, you know, maybe this is a strength for some, you know, and so I'm a little bit hesitant to be super critical about it, because, you know, again, like, there's my taste and my aesthetic and my agenda and my vision for what things should be. And that's not necessarily everyone else's. So I want to say all this with a grain of salt. You know, I want to have a big disclaimer on this, that I understand that some people are doing exactly what it is they want to do and they're enjoying it. And that's great. You know, but I also see some people who really want more and are not able to get more. And I think in part is because there's such a fierce kind of scrappiness of like we're Indianapolis, we've got something to prove, but the way we're going to prove it is we're going to be so dedicated to the local. If someone starts like getting national attention, we're suspicious of that. So there's a little bit of that goes on, and then for the people who do want to like be successful, I think there's this feeling of like, let's grow an audience in Indy. I'm sorry, but we don't have a viable market. We may be a viable market for test chain restaurants. We're not a viable market for compelling, interesting music. There's just not enough revenue. There's not enough venues or not enough audience to like, now you can make a living like being a session musician. You can make a living, you know, just doing like a weekly gig somewhere. And if that's, you know, again, if that's what you want to do, and there's people who do that well. But if you're really trying to sort of push the envelope in your particular medium, you shouldn't be playing here, in my opinion, more than 2 times a year. And your proximity to Chicago and Nashville should be fully embraced. And so I don't see that with a lot of artists. You know, a lot of artists, they'll play locally like every month, but they've never have toured. And so there just seems to be this weird, you know, membrane that surrounds Indianapolis that needs to be honestly pierced more. You know, it needs to be more osmosable, if that a word, I don't know, like where people are coming and going and you know, both like bringing in outside talent, but also exporting. I've always have talked about import export. We even did a series of 7 inches at Asthmatic Kitty called Import Export. And it was a theme of We Are City, which was that a civic sort of experiment that we did for a few years. But this idea of that exchange of ideas, you know, is really part of any healthy economy, part of any healthy community, for that matter. So I would like to see more of that. I think that's one of the weaknesses. One of the strengths is, man, I love going to shows where it's not all the same style of music. And that happens a lot in indie because it's a sort of a small scene. And so you have people, you know, you have hip-hop groups playing with punk, you know, punk bands. You have, you know, like, you know, you just have a real mixing of stuff. And I think one of the things I love about Bless is that you see some of those stylistic origins. You know, like we've got this great, you know, I mean, people probably who are in the psych rock scene would say I'm crazy to even suggest that there's psych rock influences in Bless, but I certainly think there are, at least even if it's just even a slight, you know, sprinkle. And so you see, I think there's an opportunity for a lot of really interesting hybridity of musical style to emerge from here. And I'd love to see more of that happen. I'd love to see just more artists working cross genre, because I think that's really where music is headed. And you know, it's been there before, but I think that's a unique opportunity for indie for that really unique collaboration. And again, the weakness I mentioned is a strength. You know, there is that feeling of like there is a strong feeling of a scene, and that can be very positive too.
It was dark and it was light. I was wrong and I was right. I was purging all my demons. It was certainly a fight. In the desert, ain't no water, ain't no nourishment in sight. Ain't no peasant to the slaughter, raised by mercenary minds. You could catch me bumming a car, there ain't no searching if it's worth it. Tried to cross me like a martyr, brought that climate to the surface. Pitching me rolling, skipping rocks over the stone lake. Thought sick to the bottom, but I still feel the bones break. Like a ship that sets sail, stranded in the wrong place. Like a snake eating.
Cultural Manifesto will return after this short break. I'm Kyle Long, and you're listening to Cultural Manifesto. My guest this week is the experimental musician, artist manager, and Indianapolis civic leader, Michael Kaufman. Let's return to our conversation.
Riddle, slingshot, shot, dialect, control, scattershot, chicken, feed, shotgun, shell, selling my seashore to Sally and Company, octopine, below the belt, man with voices, unfurl locks, and keys of pianos in a bag, over my shoulder, I sprinkle minor chords, over crops and fishing holes, bout troops and killer whales, I am an army of more than one, a ton, girded and weighed heavy, ranked, tanked, flanked, tasseled, low-rided, glittered, and glutzed, I slink in, 3 feet slouched and groovy, crustacean superhero, boots and
chest. Michael, the work you do is very wide-ranging and takes shape in a lot of different forms.
You mentioned that you worked for Health and Hospital Corporation for 10 years, and you were instrumental in certain aspects of the opening of Eskenazi Hospital. In the past, just looking at some of the conversations we've had here in the past, we've discussed your work with the noise rock band Therefore.
Yeah.
You also have an experimental rap project, Future Rapper. You've written a book. I mean, your work takes shape in a lot of forms. You also have a family. You have kids.
Yeah.
One thing that kind of...
That's my biggest project to date,
yeah,
by the way. It's my biggest collaboration.
Longest running project.
Well, actually not the longest running, but the most in-depth, yeah.
One thing that kind of informs, I think, all of this work is your influence from punk music.
Yeah.
And not punk music itself, but sort of the ethos and philosophy that informs punk rock music culture.
Yeah.
Is that fair to say that this is something that kind of influences all aspects of your thinking, whether it's as a parent or a manager or an artist yourself?
Absolutely. Yeah. I think both punk and I think experimental art but I think in punk, you know, it's particularly, you know, and punk is such a, like a, it's like a semantics thing, right?
Yeah. I wanted to quote something you said about it in a 2015 presentation for Creative Mornings Indianapolis titled, How Punk Prepared Me for Down Syndrome. You referred to punk as a method to disrupt the status quo. Is that kind of still how you feel about punk as a idea?
Yeah, for sure. Yeah. For sure. And so I think I think if you think of it as, you know, more from the ethos kind of framework as opposed to a stylistic framework, like, let's put that aside, right? Because, you know, because I do think in the early punk days, there was this, it was in some ways more about the spirit of disruption than the style of disruption. And so then when you look at, then sort of this definition of disruption of status quo extends both, you know, it's ancient, you know, like there's probably examples of that disruption, you know, millennia ago, and there will be millennia to come. And so, you know, so in that regard, punk is never dead, you know, maybe a certain stylistic representation of it. And I think that's what's so interesting about that punk is dead phrase is because I think, you know, the sentiment there isn't that like there aren't opportunities to disrupt. It's like as soon as that disruption becomes mass culture and becomes commodified, like it loses its impact. And so like that sentiment, there's some truth in that sentiment, right? You know, I think like what I've come to understand more and more is that why I love experimental music and experimental art is because it challenges certainty. When people are at their most certain is when they're at their most dangerous and violent. And I believe, you know, my goal in life is to end with more questions than answers. By being an audience member or a viewer of experimental music or art, it should, and hopefully it confounds you and what your expectations are. It sort of bumps up against what your tastes and aesthetics are. And I think it's critical that we are putting ourselves in that position as much as possible, in the same way that we should be meeting new people, talking to people who have different views than us. I think that discipline and that practice of allowing for disruption in our lives makes us more empathetic, makes us more patient, hopefully more inquisitive, and gracious. And, you know, so for me, that's what I learned early on in sort of my exposure to experimental music, more particularly probably like noise as a genre than punk specifically. But, you know, I think punk, that spirit of punk is as close as a concept that I resonate with as a way of describing it.
When did this become such a big influence on you as a person? You know, when I was a teenager, there used to be an all-ages punk rock venue around 42nd and College called The Sitcom. It's basically an abandoned building. And it was this youth-led punk rock space. And just going there was like this eye-opening and liberating experience for me,
yeah.
You know, to see, you know, these kids running their own space, you know, running the door, managing the money, booking the bands. It was just a very liberating thing. And that still informs what I do here, even at the radio station.
Yeah.
The do-it-yourself sort of spirit behind that and just the kind of disruption you mentioned earlier. When did that become something that impacted your life in a meaningful way?
I grew up in a fairly conservative household, not necessarily, you know, fortunately not, you know, oppressive in its conservatism. You know, my parents were always very, very, what's the word? I don't know if forgiving is even the right word, of like my...
Tolerant?
Well, and they were supportive. Like yeah. They would come out to like, you know, if I had a show, they would come out or they, you know, they were supportive. But the environment that I grew up in was more of this, you know, my father was a minister. So I grew up in a sort of evangelical, you know, not what I'm seeing as evangelical today. So, but, you know, I think it was definitely a more, well, anyways, I'm not going to even go there. But the point is that I think for me, so I actually the big breakthrough was I had a Sunday school teacher who was in a band called Truman's Water. And Truman's Water was this incredible sort of weird art rock band that was akin to Sonic Youth, The Boredoms, even early Beck. And Glenn invited me to come see a Truman's Water show. And it just, there was something in that moment that I've only had a couple experiences of this in life where something was so strange and so foreign, yet also so familiar that I knew there had to be more out there like that. And I felt like I had discovered what my true language was, even though I didn't know how to speak it. So that sort of epiphany of an experience was a pretty, you know, foundational thing. And then what was awesome is, you know, a couple of years later, I actually, or a few years later, Glenn invited me to be part of his band called Soul Junk, which was, for lack of better terms, a charismatic sort of spaz free improv hip hop group. If such a thing exists, it was us, I suppose.
So being that could be in a dirty sling, making my pies, appetize out the gunk you bring. Ingest and digest and regurgitate adobe bricks for construction induction of architectural tricks. Tears and alcoves dropping cornices by the droves. Earnest with the sternest of steeples, they hold more peoples. Invisible Republic, church overflowing. Added in armed breakfast nooks like Winchester crooks. If you can't stand this heat, try to adjust your set. Horizontal hole like a World Wide Web fed wrestler. Tangling your reception like flute caterers. Dropping trays, cacophonous free jazz percussionists.
So that experience was very foundational. And then another experience that was pretty important and all that was I went to Bucknell University after my folks moved to New York City after I graduated from high school. And I went to Bucknell, which was about a 3-hour car ride to New York, 6-hour bus ride, mind you. And I dropped out after one semester at Bucknell. I ended up going back, but I spent a semester in the city living with my folks. And I would literally just look in the Village Voice and the New Yorker and try to find the weirdest thing I could find. And I would go to it. And so that, you know, that took me to the Knitting Factory and seeing things John Zorn was doing with bringing in really interesting Japanese noise artists. I was going to the Roulette, which was this loft space. I'm literally a guy's living room. Phil Niblock, who was an experimental electronic musician, sort of drone ambient musician, I suppose, also does a lot of, you know, experiments a lot with or collaborates with video artists. There, he had a space that I was going to. You know, I ended up at a John Waters photo exhibit. I I also did things like I entered a pinball competition. I went to an open casting call for On the Road that Francis Ford Coppola was going to make. And I said something really weird to Francis Ford Coppola. I can't remember what it said exactly. But so, you know, like I would have all these experiences and I would seek them out. And it was always the music, the sort of experimental music, it really resonated with me and it felt familiar. And to the point at which now, like I also realized going back to discomfort, I try to expose myself to pop music as well, because, you know, I know that I have my own aesthetic biases and sensibilities that, you know, potentially lock me into a certain area. Anyways, that's a long answer to your question, but those are some of the key influences.
That's a great story. And I saw Truman's Water on the east side of Indianapolis in the mid-90s at a venue called City Lights. And
they
were awesome.
Yeah. No, they were an incredible live band. And it always felt like the whole thing was going to implode at any moment.
I want to go back to that 2015 Creative Mornings talk you gave, How punk prepared me for Down syndrome.
Yeah.
This was a very personal kind of story you shared during this talk about how punk and experimental art have given you, I don't know, given you tools to kind of deal with the complexities of life, or is that fair to say?
Yeah. I think going back to that willingness to be confounded, having a child with special needs is confounding. And, and my child is a disruptor. And, you know, I think a lot of times when you look at the world through the lens of punk, you start to see all these, combinations of injustice, laziness, institutions that are rigid and unaccepting, almost on a kind of an autopilot standpoint. And so, that rebellion against that conformity. But it's not even just rebellion against conformity. I think it's rebellion against the rigidness of our defaulting to efficiency and our defaulting to things that are quote unquote productive for the purpose of a capitalized existence and civilization. And so when you have a child who, by the standards of our world, are not going to be economically contributing, then what is their worth? And then you begin to realize all these ways in which we value worth upon these arbitrary and really fallible systems and oppressive systems. And so, I think I learned some of that through, doing noise music and doing being sort of in punk communities and experimental art communities. And so, nothing truly prepares you for even being a parent, and nothing truly prepares you for having a child with special needs. But I do feel like I was given a framework to begin to process that. I would go back to that, and I feel like it gave me, it gave me an ability to begin to understand that it's not my son who needs who's broken or needs fixing. It's society, and society's inability to make space for people who don't fall into the average or the mean, that for people who operate on different edges of the spectrum, that's a incomplete and unrealized potential of a truly empathetic civilization. And we just haven't allowed ourselves to pursue that for all kinds of reasons. We need to, in the same way that we need to be lifelong learners in all that we do, I think our cultural institutions and our cultural economies need to be having an attitude of learning. And the best way to do that is to experiment and to do things that we haven't done before, but also to bring in things that we haven't brought in before. So it doesn't have to always be experimental. I mean, it can just even be, you know, being exposed to an idea or a culture that's not your own, right? It's as simple as that. So I think that's one of the reasons why I feel it's important to not only elevate and celebrate the value of experimental music and art and noise, not just as something that helps us see the world differently, but that can profoundly change the way that we think about others.
Michael, what we've jumped from topic to topic today, and I'm going to jump again. What's next for you? I mean, how long have you been in Indianapolis living at this point? 15 years? Or is it longer?
I've been here almost 18 years.
18 years.
Yeah, this is the longest I've ever lived any place.
Yeah,
good question. I'm mostly, focusing on, this helping build out the Greenway system. I am excited to, continue to do my work with Sunlux and Holland Andrews. I'm actively writing. So the noise band, therefore, that you mentioned, we stopped making music at some point, and now we're writing essays, which has been very, very rewarding. We're writing sort of something shy of a manifesto, if that can be done. And, my personal mission statement is to work with others to make space for others to experience and contribute to surprising beauty. And, I think that's what I'll continue to do. And, and surprising beauty, I should say, as someone who was just talking about noise, experimental music, to use the word beauty and talking about paradigms is a very loaded term. That's why surprising is in front of the word beauty. So just need to add that footnote.
Michael, are there any final thoughts you want to share? Anything I didn't ask you about that you wanted to express?
I guess I want to end on a positive note about Indianapolis, because I do think there can be I know some people perceive me to be generally down on Indy, which is not the case. I think I find it to be part of my role to be a bit of a contrarian here and a critic on certain things. I think it's important. It doesn't mean that I don't love and support the people who are involved in that. And also, I don't fully understand or know, what their challenges are, what they're dealing with, or their realities that they have to meet. But I do think it's important if we can be, thoughtful and kind critics. I think that's important. I'd like to see that fostered more in our community, because I think the intention is, if the intention is to help people and help ourselves be better versions of ourselves, I think we would all benefit from that. I'll close with this, because this is something I'm really fascinated with right now. And this is going to be the weirdest way to close a cultural manifesto ever, I promise.
Good.
I'm obsessed with the 5-pound gut biome that each of us carry in our bodies. We have this infinite colony of bacterial wonders. Some good, some not great, but that all work in this like very complicated ecosystem that, is like the almost like carrying the Amazon forest in your stomach. And I think that, we have a body that is Indianapolis as a city. I don't think we're fostering our gut biome enough. There's not enough weirdness. There's not enough small stuff. There's not enough small activity. We don't celebrate all these little things, all these unique cultures, all these unique people who really are so critical to our survival. We're so focused on on the bones and the muscles and the brain and the heart. And that stuff's important, but like if we ignore sort of the dark, you know, cavern and the beautiful mysteries and things that are brewing in there, and we don't give it an opportunity to do its job, you know, we'll just be a skeleton. And so here's to the cultural gut biome of Indianapolis.
Perfect. Perfect way to end. Thank you so much, Michael. I'm a big fan of everything you do. So thank you for being here.
I thank you for having me, Kyle. I'm a big fan of you, very much so.
My guest this week has been the experimental musician, artist manager, and Indianapolis civic leader, Michael Kaufman. You can learn more about Michael's work and read some of the essays he's written at punksyndrome.com. The month of May is designated as Asian American and Pacific Islander Heritage Month. For the remainder of this week's show, I want to celebrate Asian American and Pacific Islander Heritage Month by sharing music from Mar Mar Ai, an important Burmese singer who's been living in Fort Wayne, Indiana since 1998. Indiana is home to one of the largest Burmese populations in the United States. According to a 2021 article published by the Indianapolis Star, roughly 35,000 Burmese people reside in Indiana. Mar Mar Ai is currently 80 years old. She's known as one of Myanmar's most popular and prolific vocalists. Mar Mar Ai began performing professionally in Myanmar as a child. She's recorded a wide variety of popular and classical music over the years, developing a reputation as one of Myanmar's greatest performers of traditional music. And we'll hear two songs from a brilliant collection of Mar Mar Ai's music titled Pleasant Morning Songs. Up first, we'll hear The Pleasant Sensation, followed by Paying Homage to Five Infinite Benefactors. We've been celebrating Asian American and Pacific Islander Heritage Month by listening to music from Mar Mar Ai, an important Burmese singer who's been living in Fort Wayne, Indiana since 1998. Thanks to my guest this week, Michael Kaufman, and thank you for tuning in. I'm Kyle Long, and you've been listening to Cultural Manifesto.